Welcome to On the Brink Radio, broadcast number 207. This is Jeff Phillips Wefferson coming at you from the Darwin Botanical Garden. It's Friday, the 14th of July, 2017. My past few weeks in Darwin have been really, really powerful. It's been quite paradoxical to feel the magic of the top end where some of the most beautiful and powerful things in my life have happened to me, versus the sometimes overwhelming military-industrial presence here, especially all the military aircraft that have been coming and going for the past month. But trying to separate out all the signals that my finely tuned human neurobiological antenna has been receiving. There have been moments, especially when we were out at Litchfield National Park a few days ago, when I got out of the city and out actually into the true outback dream time, away from people and civilization, that I did feel the beautiful, timeless dreamtime magic that characterizes the Australia that I know and love so well. But trying to separate that out from the intense amount of military-industrial noise that I've been picking up on has been quite challenging. I spend a lot of time at the Botanical Gardens here because it's very much of a sacred nematon, a sacred grove of trees, a mega-nematon, kind of like the Botanical Garden in Hobart or Christchurch, where the giant trees are very much friends of mine and provide a very beautiful spiritual environment where I can really think and be in touch with nature and the dream time. But I've been drawn to spend a lot of time in the Botanical Garden here, not just to escape the noise of where I'm staying, but to be in communion with the waters and the trees and the beautiful spirits of nature that I love so well. But in situations like this, I feel like I'm able to tune into messages, if you will, that are coming from the Dreamtime ancestors. And I don't claim to have any special abilities that other people don't have, or I'm not privy to transmissions or anything like that. But I just sort of try to rely on my own intuition and to quiet my own internal dialogue down so that I can really feel and perceive and respond to the vibrations and emanations coming from Mother Nature and the deeper levels of reality. But what I've gleaned this time is that I seem to feel that the Dreamtime ancestors are imparting a very serious warning about the whole situation with humanity and Mother Earth. And of course, this is a common theme that I talk about on just about every one of my On the Brink radio shows. In fact, the title, On the Brink, implies a sense of urgency. But what I've tried to do for this show is to distill out what seems to be a convergence of some disturbing trends in the domain of human activity. And again, if you're familiar with my show, you'll know that much of what I try to deal with is to transcend the strictly human domains of reality and to look at the effect that human military-industrial civilization is having on Mother Earth from the perspective of our fellow beings, for example, the whales and dolphins, or from the perspective of Mother Earth herself, a true planetary being, an intelligence totally beyond anything that we can hope to truly understand. In the interest of an analysis of what's happening in the human worlds of today, three things have really come onto my radar recently. One of them is a very interesting article that's verbalizing something that I've been thinking about for many years, but it's an application of science to looking at science itself. One of the best examples of that I noticed was a few years ago, a professor, Dr. Whiting O'Keefe, a Caltech professor living in New Zealand, wrote a very brilliant analytical article about New Zealand's use of this pesticide called 1080. But a big part of this article was a scientific evaluation of the scientific process, which I think is very useful to understanding what's happening in the world. But this article, it's about how possibly as much as 50% of all the scientific research that's passing as peer-reviewed these days, as much as 50% of this is totally bogus or inaccurate or even just fake. And how this has come about, you know, like any other human process, it's subject to the weaknesses and flaws of people. But I think that the whole thing of the economic or financial aspect of science being able to be bought off, the search for truth having a price, or the desired scientific finding to be prepaid ahead of time by the funders of the research, who often happen to be branches of the military and the Pentagon. But a big example of this is the whole climate change thing. There's been a slew of articles recently. Again, you have to, you know, you get like, well, who can you trust in saying all this stuff? But I think it's really true. I've perceived intuitively for a long time that the whole climate change scenario is a hoax. And I won't go into that on this show. I've covered it many times before. Another example of the sort of fake science dimension is the control of about between 50 and 70% of all marine biology research worldwide by the U.S. Navy. And again, this has to do with the financial aspects of the funding of research, both overtly and covertly. There's a military term called information dominance that has to do with essentially the use of mass communication as an instrument of propaganda, which I've covered in my concept called infotoxin on my website called regainyourbrain.org. It's a very good source of information on the whole psychology of mass media and the weaponization of mass communication, and the orchestration of perceived reality. Like, I think an example of this right now, I was just reading a really brilliant article by John Pilger, the expatriate Australian journalist who now lives in England. He's written a lot of really brilliant articles and made some awesome documentary films about the plight of the indigenous people of Australia. Well, this article is about he calls it the coming war with China. And, you know, I don't really know that war with China is coming, but he does share a lot of information. For example, he tells the name of Admiral Harry Harris, who is the sort of the propaganda chief of the Pentagon. And it could be from his office or his command that the whole North Korean missile threat has sprung. I was reading an article from Fairness and Accuracy in Reporting a few weeks ago about how a think tank in Washington, D.C. called CSIS, the Center for Strategic and International Studies, they're a major think tank that advises the U.S. government on the appropriation and deployment of new weapons systems. Well, they were strongly recommending that the U.S. invest many billions of dollars in what's called the THAADS, the Terminal High Altitude Air Defense System. It's a very complex system of nuclear missiles and radar designed by Lockheed that CSIS has recommended that the U.S. install in its bases in South Korea. And now they want to install the same type system, first strike nuclear missile capabilities on the island of Kauai in Hawaii. Because CSIS is largely funded by Lockheed, which is documented by FAIR, it just goes to show that the whole North Korean missile thing could be orchestrated covertly through the intelligence communities and branches of the Pentagon to provide justification for the deployment in investment in these massive new weapons technologies. Just an example of Lockheed, who also, in the wake of the Christchurch quake in 2011, Lockheed now controls the entire military apparatus of New Zealand. Anyway, a lot of this is kind of an example of what I call the Sagan paradox, which is astronomer Carl Sagan observed that we live in a world where almost every person in Western society is exposed every day to many forms of advanced technology, the results of scientific innovation, mechanization, and research, a lot of it sort of moving into the dimension of almost the science fiction realm. We're exposed to this and use it all the time, but very few people have even a rudimentary scientific understanding in order to make sense of what these technologies are, how they operate, what their dangers are. So this is one of the biggest paradoxes of living in the world today. So anyway, that's one of the first sort of disturbing trends that it's really been happening for a long time, but people are starting to talk about it now. The trend in how a lot of science can't really be trusted, even though it's coming from people in white lab coats that are figures of authority, and from highly formally respected scientific journals like Nature and Science and biomedical journals, can't necessarily believe all this stuff. You've got to sort of be a scientist yourself and apply that degree of critical thinking and rigor to all the different ideas and information that you might be exposed to. Now, a second disturbing trend that, again, it's nothing new, but it keeps going to new thresholds is, and I'd like to thank my friends at Stranded No More for their brilliant ongoing work. They posted an article a couple of days ago about how now AI or artificial intelligence systems are going to be used to help in the decision-making processes regarding what's going to happen with stranded whales. And this just seems like a totally ludicrous idea. It really made me think of Dr. John Lilly's kind of science fiction observation, but I think there may really be something to it. I've talked about this a lot of times on the show. His idea that he perceived a battle of sorts going on Mother Earth now between the forces of water-based life, which is life as we know her, water-based life made of carbon, water, DNA, versus what he called the solid-state entity, a form of electronic intelligence that did not occur naturally on Earth, but that has been using us to construct it in the form of silicon-based electronics and computers, artificial intelligence, and this whole line of technology, which is only possible because we're living on an artificially electrified planet, thanks to Nikola Tesla. But then the whole system of what we call computers, which really aren't computers in the true etymological sense. They're dynucrudes, digital number-crunching devices. But these vast number-crunching systems make all of these technologies possible. Jerry Mander, in his book, In the Absence of the Sacred, has a great chapter on megatechnology and how the dangers of computers, because they're who make all these other forms of advanced technology possible. Nuclear power and weapons, microwave weapon systems, genetic engineering, everything radioactive and nuclear. None of this would be possible or manageable without computers. But anyway, John Lilly pointed out that in this scenario of water-based versus solid-state life, that the solid-state entity, their biggest enemy was the whales and dolphins, because the whales and dolphins, as Lilly saw it, were functioning as repeater stations for the signals of water-based life coming from other star systems and other galaxies. The whales and dolphins were maintaining these signals to and from Mother Earth, and the solid-state entity knew this, and because the solid-state entity does not like water or water-based life, it was seeking to get rid of the whales and dolphins in any way possible. And one of them was the sort of subconscious or covert manipulation of the world's military to try to get them to wage war against life in the ocean. And you can see a clear example of that in a chapter that I've quoted from numerous times by Admiral William Nirenberg, who was the head of NATO back in the late 1960s and head of the Scripps Institute. He said that the way that the U.S. military looked at whales and dolphins or other beings in the ocean was that they were basically forms of biological interference that would cast sonar bogeys that would interfere with effective warfighting. So implicitly, one of their goals is to sort of clear fell the ocean of any larger life forms that can interfere with warfighting. And DARPA has come up with a form of technology that seems designed to do exactly that. It's a predator drone submarine or boat that is totally unmanned, but it's full-sized, and it's got several dozen different kinds of energetic microwave, sonar, radar, electronic weapons systems, and surveillance and detection and communication and tracking devices on there. And it's likely that this is sort of the model for a new generation of undersea drones that could be on the drawing boards or even being manufactured right now. And this also relates to the whole paradigm of robotic mining that has been going on in Australia. At least three sites run by Rio Tinto have been totally robotic for several years now, with the only people on site being mechanics that are there to repair the machines when they break down. A third major convergence, a trend that's involved with this, is the looking at just the whole existence of the military-industrial civilization as a form of de facto warfare on Mother Earth. And again, this is a theme I've talked about many, many, many times on the show. But I'd really like to credit the work of Dr. Rosalie Bertell, who was a Catholic nun, a medical doctor, an outspoken activist on behalf of life and sanity with respect to understanding the global nuclear scenario. And then, later on with her second book called Planet Earth, Latest Weapon of War, a groundbreaking look at the whole, what was then in 1990, or no, I guess it came out in the year 2000, a brilliant look at the new generation of warfighting technologies based on geoengineering, the weaponization of planetary geophysical processes and microwave weapons, for example, HARP and other giant transmitters that basically function as one integrated unit all over the planet. Rosalie Bertell pointed out that just the existence of the whole military juggernaut was itself a threat to life on this planet. The whole socio-political costs and the whole economic costs and primarily the environmental effects and costs of just the existence of all these weapon systems and the support structures, the materials, the raw materials that go into it, the side effects of their existence, the fact that these weapon systems become obsolete overnight, and if they haven't been used in actual warfare, then they've got to be disposed of so they can buy new ones. This whole never-ending circle, this is almost an invisible mega environmental crisis happening all over the world, involved with all things military. I've talked before about how the word civilization really has nothing to do with going to art galleries and having tea and having your rose garden and riding horses and sipping wine with your friends. This, we think of this as civilized behavior. Civilized people don't go out and blow things up and murder indigenous people and stuff. What they do is they pay other people to do that for them, because civilization, in truth, comes from the Latin word civitas, that means city. So civilization literally means living in cities. And we've been doing that for about 5,000 years. And with the dawn of living in cities came the whole regimentation and the literal war on Mother Earth that's required for building cities. primarily violating the Hopi prophecy of, if we dig precious things from the land, we will invite disaster. Because to build a city, you've got to mine out a bunch of like rock and other precious metals and stuff. This is like way back in the day. And then it's expanded onto, as we progressed into more modern times, the mining of gold, for whatever reason, the mining of iron to make steel, the discovery of hydrocarbons, draining them from the body of Mother Earth, then the whole nuclear scenario being born from the mining of uranium and other radioactive metals. So the whole mining is a violation of the Hopi prophecy that in itself is a form of warfare. And if you look at the implications of all of these, all of this truly amounts to war. So we keep sitting here thinking, people in the modern world think that, oh, we better be careful because war might happen. But war is all around us. We're living on the backbone of war. War doesn't mean giant armies of aircraft and soldiers with guns going out blowing each other up. That's the traditional definition of war, but war is really what I call our unconscious jihad against nature. It's the very fabric of day-to-day life. For example, the automobile is one of the biggest forms of warfare that the average person is engaged in. I mean, you can map this out scientifically in terms of its destructive impacts from how they're made, what it runs on, the effects of their unlimited amount of literally light years of driving per year that happens. The amount of human and non-human lives that are lost to the automobile. This is a form of warfare. The form of warfare on the human mind being conducted by mass media, especially this very advanced weapon system known as television. There's a very interesting book by Canadian researcher Joyce Nelson called The Perfect Machine, Television in the Nuclear Age. And I highly recommend that you read this book. I'd like to post some excerpts from it on one of my blogs when I have time. But she points out the parallels between the development and manufacturing and distribution of nuclear reactors and television, both by the same companies. For example, General Electric, who interestingly had board members during World War II that were simultaneously members of GE and of Nazi Germany. So this is very interesting. But she points out that Pentagon strategists referred to television as the atomic bomb of the mind. So that it was originally conceived as a weapon system, and not many people understand that. I'd like to go back to the work of Dr. Rosalie Bertell, who I have a great amount of respect for, and her work is being carried on by Dr. Claudia von Werloff in Austria, who I've interviewed three times on my show. They've got a new edition of Rosalie's book, Planet Earth, Latest Weapon of War, that should be coming out soon. But Rosalie's first book is called No Immediate Danger, Prognosis for a Radioactive Earth. And in it, it's a very profound and illuminating and educational look at the whole global nuclear scenario and the health effects of ionizing radiation and how dispelling the myth that there is such a thing as a safe level of ionizing radiation, there isn't. That was clearly understood by all the scientists from the Manhattan Project era who were opposed to atomic weapons, or even some of the Manhattan scientists themselves, like Dr. John Goffman, who realized what it was and came out against it. Also Dr. Linus Pauling, Dr. Sternglass. These are all people you can read to get the true story on ionizing radiation, which we're all, the whole world is saturated with it right now. Close to 2,000 synthetic fission products and their constantly created daughter products. We're actually living in an invisible nuclear war. According to Dr. Ted Wyman, who was one of the, he's a Canadian physician that went to Iraq after the Gulf War, and he and some other doctors risk their lives to get samples of dust from these tanks that had been exploded with depleted uranium, and he got radiation poisoning himself in order to tell us about the extremely dangerous levels of radiation there from the DU. And I'd like to compliment David Bradbury, an Australian filmmaker who made two brilliant films back about 13, 14 years ago. One was called Blowing in the Wind, and the next one was called A Hard Rain. These are two really good educational looks at the global nuclear scenario. Blowing in the Wind, focusing on the use of DU at Shoalwater Bay off of Rockhampton in the southern part of the Great Barrier Reef World Heritage Area, where right now, in the middle of July and for the next few weeks, the largest military war game that the U.S. and Australia have, it's called Operation Talisman Sabre. It's going on there right now. And it's so ironic because they call it a game, but they're literally doing, practicing everything related to what would happen in a real war, except they may not be blowing up any ships, they may not be causing any human life, but everything short of that, which in reality is a form of especially environmental warfare itself, they are doing. There's over 30,000 U.S. and Australian troops doing amphibious landings, many, many, many dozens of aircraft, over 20 huge Australian and U.S. warships there. Every one of these is fully decked out with the whole latest generation of electromagnetic and microwave weapons, as I've documented in my numerous interviews with Terry Lilly and Stuart Simonson. This is just not on the public radar. Also, I've learned, thanks to Margaret Pistorius of the Peace Convergence Movement, that not only is the USS George Washington came through Cairns to go to Shoalwater Bay, but also the USS Ronald Reagan, which now that's a very interesting story. It's a giant aircraft carrier who was in the Sea of Japan at the time of the Fukushima disaster. Some people say that the USS Ronald Reagan was actually towing that giant floating HAARP platform, the SBX dome that's mounted on a Norwegian oil rig, that was in the Sea of Japan, and that was part of the HAARP technology system that was used to create the earthquake and subsequent tidal wave that caused the Fukushima disaster. This is the story. Who knows? But what's come out in recent months, and apparently this is being documented from several credible sources, including Dr. Chris Busby, who I'm friends with on Facebook, that the USS Ronald Reagan became so radioactive from all the highly radioactive seawater that it was taken in into the ship's water purification systems and just everything. Everything on the ship became so radioactive that many, many, many of the soldiers on there got radiation sickness, and they have this radiation sickness now, and that there's a massive lawsuit against all these personnel from the USS Ronald Reagan back in 2011 against the U.S. Navy. And they were even talking about that the USS Ronald Reagan was going to have to be decommissioned because it's so radioactive for a few years there, no port would let it dock there because it was so radioactive with all these people. I mean, this is an absolute horror story. But now, supposedly, the Ronald Reagan is in Shoalwater Bay. So I'm not there to see it, and like all this stuff, it's all secondhand information. It's possible that none of it's true. It could be that everything I think I know is wrong or a hoax, but I don't think so. I really think that, you know, the U.S. gets blamed for its hegemonic enterprise in terms of the probably close to 1,000 military bases that they have set up all around the world now. But if you look at who the driving and controlling forces behind the U.S. are, well, we won't name any names or point any fingers, but it's really futile to name any certain names or point fingers at certain entities because it's a truly global process. You can say that the U.S. might be ramping up for war against China, which I don't necessarily think so. I think a lot of it's just what they call saber-rattling in order to keep the public distracted and afraid, on edge, and to justify the existence of an ever-escalating levels of military technology that's draining off, literally. John Pilger says that the U.S. has spent over $5 trillion on armaments and weapon systems just since 9/11. But that's exactly, that was the purpose of 9/11. If you don't buy the box cutter story and Osama bin Laden as being the mastermind of that and understand the reality that it was actually a pre-planned false flag event, it was the new Pearl Harbor called for by the PNAC, the Project for a New American Century, in a document in 1996. They called for the necessity of a new Pearl Harbor to catalyze what they call a revolution in military affairs. And that's exactly what this has happened. That's what that $5 trillion has gone for. That's just the money we know about. I mean, there's, who knows? I mean, the amount of money that can exist is only equal to the number of zeros that can be put in computers. It's all this, just this giant hallucination in the human mind. We're all kind of trapped in it. But the part that really matters is not what we say, but what we do, how Mother Earth and all our fellow beings perceive and feel and experience our actions and our presence here. So that's a big, big, big part of what my work is all about, is trying to transcend the strictly human way of looking at things and to try to allow myself to be invited into the minds of my fellow beings, the whales and dolphins, the trees, the forest, the spirit of the waters, and to allow my consciousness to blend with them and allow their beautiful spirit to share with me their experience of us. And I really feel a sense of tranquility and unity when I'm really deep in nature. And it's quite ironic that I'm in such a beautiful location right now talking about all this crazy stuff. But that's part of the paradox of being here now as a human being. The necessity of not being in denial of the heaviest stuff that I see my species involved in. Because I really think that regardless of our degree of direct participation in the war on life, I think that every human being shares in the responsibility for what every member of our species is doing on whatever level that might be happening and whatever kinds of effects it might be having on Mitikaya Yasin or all our family of life. I'd really like to compliment my friend Terry Lilly, Mr. Limpet, the marine biologist in Kauai. He's really been documenting lately the onslaught of the grotesque, amplified militarization of the once beautiful island of Kauai. He's been talking all this week about giant swarms of helicopters coming and disrupting all the endangered species of birds. And he's already documented how the microwave systems have destroyed the coral reefs. And just when he thought he had them shipped off to offshore, they've come back with a vengeance, and all the local politicians are supporting them. The move for all these high-powered radar systems to be installed there, and new THAADs missile and IGIS missile systems, and making Kauai into a full-on first-strike nuclear missile installation with everything aimed not at North Korea, but at China. Same with all the missile bases in U.S. military complexes in the Philippines and in South Korea and the whole chain of islands, Guam, all the way down to the top end of Australia where I am now. I've got a map that I'd like to thank my friend Gaetan Sell for making for me last night. It shows the air distances between Kauai to North Korea and from Darwin to North Korea. And John Pilger says that Australia is America's most obsequious partner. And obsequious means servile or attentive in a very sort of ludicrous way. That you're just, obsequious means that you're just sitting there waiting for your master to just tell you what to do. And he thinks that Australia's relationship to America is like that. But, you know, it makes sense because John Pilger said he thought Australia was like the 51st state, but also a colony of England. It doesn't really have any independence of its own. All the military bases here are pretty much de facto U.S. bases. I learned last year that Australia basically gave, or, you know, sold, an area called Woomera, which is an area in South Australia where they did a lot of nuclear testing, an area the size of Texas. They sold this to Raytheon, the Raytheon Corporation, for about $267 million. So that they can create the world's most advanced weapons testing facility. Well, who knows what they could put on there. The newest, highest level of HAARP-type technologies. They could even, you know, my intuition has been that I'm sure that every USS aircraft carrier that comes to Australia has nuclear missiles. And also that other destroyers and probably even smaller vessels have nuclear missiles too. Australia is no stranger to the nuclear scenario. So here in Australia, not only do we have the grotesque military buildup happening at the top end here, which has caused me to liken Darwin to being the Hawaii of Australia, but you've got the purchase or gift of Woomera to Raytheon. You've got the whole massive undersea warfare presence on the Great Barrier Reef, mainly based in Cairns, that Terry Lilly and Stuart Simonson have been saying that's one of the primary causes of the death of the Great Barrier Reef. All the electromagnetic and microwave emanations there, coupled with the shipping lanes. And you've also got among the 40-plus U.S. military bases in Australia, probably the most central one of all is called Pine Gap. It's an electronic warfare facility in the central desert located near Alice Springs. And it's sort of essential to the global electronic intelligence network. Anyway, to sum everything up, I think that the greatest danger we're facing is that through whatever reasons that it's happened and it's been going on for a long time, through processes that we just take as normal or that we think are actually helping us, the Industrial Revolution, the automobile, electricity, the wheel, fire, gunpowder, atomic weapons, genetic engineering, computers, all of these have given us all these great benefits like plastic and petroleum and nuclear waste and cancer and a whole range of degenerative diseases that never existed before in modern times. So I live in this civilization as much as anybody, and I'm grateful for the chance to be here now, but I really just don't think that it has any kind of benefit to life on Earth, including us. It may be some short-term benefits, but I think it's ultimately a Faustian bargain. We have sold our souls to the devil, and the time is coming due when Mother Earth simply won't be able to or will be unwilling to sustain our presence here in the form that we're in now, which is not really the true us. But I think that really, with respect to some of the microwave stuff happening around the planet, the nuclear scenario, but most recently, planetary-level geoengineering experiments, and this is just the stuff we know about, but it's really, you know, they're actually targeting the sun, trying to interfere with the processes of the sun and the electromagnetic and gravitational connections between the Earth and the sun, or what you call the heliocosm. These processes, both direct and indirectly, are influencing and disrupting the Earth's magnetic field, which is central to the Earth's stability as a planet. And I think that the Earth's magnetic field is also central to the ability for Mother Earth to protect herself from celestial impacts coming from comets and asteroids that have bombarded Earth many times throughout history. I think even during the time when humans have been here, but we've repressed and are in denial of these cataclysmic events because it forced our ancestors to live through a situation so horrific that we didn't even know if we would make it or not. And so I think that the whales and dolphins do have a memory of these catastrophes that our ancestors have lived through. So one of my biggest hopes, and I feel it happening. I don't claim to be any sort of special psychic or with special abilities or anything, but I really feel that if you're close enough to the whales and dolphins and your mind is quiet enough and your spirit pure enough that you can receive information from them that clarifies exactly what I'm talking about. And I've really been getting very powerful intuitions, not only from the whales and dolphins, but from all the Dreamtime ancestors here in the Top End, that we're really crossing the Atlantean threshold now, which it's based on the story that's come down to us from Plato, but that Atlantis was an ancient civilization who, through the misuse of their advanced technologies, brought upon their own destruction. And maybe they caused their own continent to sink, and or maybe they opened up themselves to being taken out by the healing processes of Mother Earth that the Great Spirit uses to heal Koyaanisqatsi. And I'll close with the message of Hopi Elder Thomas Banyaka, who in 1986, when we were in Flagstaff, he told us that there's no way we're going to avert or prevent the Day of Purification, which is the time when Mother Earth and the Great Spirit heals the Earth of all that's out of balance with life. We're not going to prevent that from happening. And it could come any day now, any time. But through the summation of all of our good works, and if we all made really positive and powerful changes in our life to show that we love life, that we might lessen the severity of the purification on behalf of all of our family of life, so that the people of one heart of all the kingdoms of life might be spared, and that they might have to live through less difficult times, or that they might even make it at all, so that they, whoever survives, can be the seeds of the new creation. And so there is a hope of continuity. Mother Earth must be cleansed of Koyaanisqatsi, because things are just getting worse and worse. And I don't think it's going to be through anything that we have the ability to do on our own. I think it's going to be despite anything we do. It's our instinct to try to keep on doing what we're doing. Anyway, just some thoughts. I don't really know what's going on, but I felt like I should try to share all these things from my beautiful time here in the Top End. But this is Jeff Lefferson signing off. I love all you guys. Thank you so much for listening. And may Goddess help us all. May Goddess bless all the Homo sapiens. All right, goodbye from the Top End of Darwin and some beautiful reflections of water.
Thank you. the Anti-Media Radio. Your host, Nick Burnaby, here on UCY.